Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We're definitely in the midst of a scientific revolution, as our knowledge of genetics and our ability to manipulate genes is unprecedented. Another area undergoing rapid development and understanding is the concept of the microbiome, that collection of bacteria, fungi, and viruses that live inside and on every one of us. And though we fear the pathologic ones making us sick, actually, for the most part, they promote good health and biological balance, provided we treat our microbiomes right. My guest today, science journalist and author Catherine Harmon Courage, explores the role of diverse foods from across the world, particularly those featuring fermented foods, both as delectable tastes, but part of a broad palate that ensures optimal gut flora and promotes better overall health. Her new book is called Cultured: How Ancient Foods Can Feed Our Microbiome, and it's just out from Avery. Her previous book was called Octopus: The Most Mysterious Creature in the Sea. Courage is a science journalist and editor whose work has appeared in Scientific American, The New York Times, Wired, and National Geographic, among many others. She'll be appearing in Tulsa for a reading and signing at Magic City Books on March 20th at 7 p.m. Tulsa is her hometown, though she now resides near Boulder, Colorado, which happens to be a hotbed of fermented foods, it turns out. Catherine Harmon Courage, author of Cultured, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Catherine Harmon Courage, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just reminding us, if you will, about the microbiome and how do you define it, and I guess how many different types and quantity of bacteria we're talking about. The numbers are kind of staggering when you don't really know about this kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks for having me. The human microbiome is a collection of microbes that live in and on our bodies, and it is really staggering, and we've really learned so much over the last several years about just how many species are living in our bodies. We didn't usually grow up thinking about the fact that we share our bodies with so many different organisms. There are, 40 trillion or so individual microbes living in our guts, and really many, many, many times more microbial genes in our bodies than human genes. So it's a really kind of an interesting new way to think about our own bodies and health.
So you've been on this beat, as it were, the microbiome beat, I think, for several years. I guess one of the things I was wondering is, how did you even get to this beat? There have been several books about the microbiome specifically, and there's so many ways in which we think it impacts our health now, both physically as well as mentally, emotionally. I mean, it's fascinating because it seems like there are almost endless possibilities for how we think the microbiome interacts with our bodies. And I guess, how did you get to the beat? And then I can ask you more specific questions about, health aspects of it.
I started covering the microbiome actually 10 years ago now, which is amazing to think about. It's been that long, and we've learned so much in that time. But it was really just, I was a new reporter working at Scientific American on the health and biology beat, looking through studies that were coming out that would be interesting things to write about. And I came across a study from something called the Human Microbiome Project. And I thought, well, this sounds pretty interesting, and looked into it. And at that point, we were really just at the very beginning of starting to get a catalog of all of the microbes that live in and on our bodies. And so they were really just starting to kind of get a census of who was there. And so just this concept that our bodies are kind of this own ecological zone of all these other organisms was just so fascinating to me. And so over the years, I've just continued to cover it and pay attention to it as the science has progressed, from kind of learning who's there to trying to figure out what exactly they're doing for our bodies.
Yeah, and so the foods we eat are really instrumental, I think. One thing I should point out is that the microbiome, you can think about it in a population type level. So we sort of, as Americans say, which obviously means a lot of different things to different people, but if we generally eat sort of similar types of food that don't have a lot of variability, we may wind up with very similar microbiomes. And yet at the same time, a microbiome is almost like an individual signature, right? Like each individual can have a slightly different makeup of the different bacteria or fungi that live in our gut, in our colons particularly, and how many of those different species are there and that type of a thing. Is that an accurate way of saying it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting because we share so much of our human DNA with every other human on the planet, but we share so little of our microbial DNA with even our closest neighbors and people we might live with. So it really is, as you mentioned, kind of an individual fingerprint, and one too that's dynamic and changes over time as well.
So it seems like an evolving field, or it's something that's really unfolding, is there seems to be a lot more consumer health literature about how we kind of optimize our own microbiomes. And, you know, your book is really almost like a worldwide tour of different types of foods that have been processed is a sort of a negative word, so I won't use, but fermented is really the truth in so many different ways. Do you have an overall general sense of what you'd want a reader or a listener to take away from this idea of how to sort of optimize your microbiome, or do you think the science is too premature at this point?
Yeah, I think we are. This is just, I think, the very beginning. It feels like so much research has come out, but we're still, yes, at the very beginning of understanding our microbiome and how it impacts our health and how diet and lifestyle play into all of that. But we do kind of have some general trends and some general ideas that we can, I think, start to apply to our lifestyles and diets. And one of those is certainly eating more fermented foods with live microbes in them. It kind of goes back to this idea of the hygiene hypothesis or this other idea of the old friends hypothesis that our bodies have really evolved to expect so many more microbes that we come in than we come into contact with today in kind of our sanitized, clean lives, that really exposing the body to more microbes through fermented foods and other ways can really help, you know, quell the immune system or just get our bodies back to being exposed to those expected microbes. And then the other side is really eating more fiber and whole foods that can feed the microbes that live in our gut. So I think those are kind of two takeaways that the science is pretty solid on at this point. But there will be so many more developments in the coming years, I think, about more specific ways we can fine-tune our microbiomes.
Say a little bit more about that. Like, we have managed to refine our foods, and by that I do mean processed foods that we commonly see in the grocery store. So there isn't a lot of whole fiber. And the fiber is very important because it is something that we can't really break down ourselves, but we rely on those colonic bacteria to do it for us. But it also provides nutrition for them. So it's very important in kind of this commensal relationship that we have.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that has gotten left out a lot. Obviously, it might be more exciting to talk about kombucha or kimchi or these kind of exciting fermented foods than it is to talk about fiber, which sounds pretty boring. But it is really important in feeding our native microbes to look for those whole fibers and different kinds of foods. They're called prebiotic fibers if they make it down to the large intestine and feed our local beneficial microbes. And I think a key really is, too, to look for those whole foods with various kinds of fiber in them and not just, you know, kind of rely on one single fiber supplement or foods that have a specific type of fiber added back in for that purpose.
What are your favorite examples of foods with fiber?
I mean, a lot of just looking at whole grains, a lot of beans and lentils are excellent for that. There are some vegetables that maybe a lot of us don't eat that often. There are sunchokes, also called Jerusalem artichokes, that are actually really delicious when they're roasted. They're kind of these knobby little tubery things, but they have a lot of this prebiotic fiber called inulin, which is good for our gut microbes. And then in reporting my book, I discovered that there have been some studies looking into cocoa, kind of whole cocoa powder, unsweetened cocoa powder, that does also feed our gut microbes, and they produce beneficial compounds as a result. So that was pretty exciting news. We can eat a little bit more cocoa in our diets.
I was definitely intrigued by that. And in fact, you have a recipe in there for cocoa, I guess, with oatmeal that I think one of the people you interviewed was a champion of. I guess his wife wasn't such a big fan. But that was the other pleasant surprise in the book. There are, you know, not a ton, but a few recipes in almost every one of the chapters, depending on what food type you're talking about how you can ferment or make these things for yourself and try it out. And you were very clear that there's a little bit of trial and error involved here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one fun thing I discovered in my travels and reporting is just, you know, how easy it is and really tasty to integrate these foods into our everyday lifestyles and cuisines and habits.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Catherine Harmon Courage, who is a journalist and writer. She's the author of the brand new book, Cultured, How Ancient Foods Can Feed Our Microbiome. And she's going to be appearing in Tulsa on March 20th at 7 p.m. at Magic City Books to talk about her book and sign copies. And Catherine, you are from Tulsa. You grew up here, right?
Yeah, I did.
Do you get back here often?
I do, about once a year or twice a year.
Nice. So, but it'll be like a homecoming for you on this book tour.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be great to be back. Every time I come back for a visit, it's just better and better. There are wonderful things going on.
Yes, there's no doubt that Tulsa is a place that is on the rise. Now, you, I wanted to ask specifics about the book, and you arrange it very neatly into chapters. So there might be what you'd think of as the things that are handled by bacteria, for example, yogurt or cheese are things we understand are created the way they are because they have live active cultures in some cases, or cheese, it's usually the fermentation process has already happened by the time the cheese is ready for us to consume. And then you spend a considerable amount of time, I think, because of it, it's in vogue right now, is this chapter, consider the pickle produce, right? So this is the idea of fermenting vegetables particularly. And kimchi is kind of the archetypal example of this. It comes to us, I guess, from like Korean food culture, but there are many American entrepreneurs and food companies that are now looking into fermenting other vegetables because we're thinking of it as enhancing our health or providing better bacterial cultures to our microbiome. Are there a couple of examples? I guess kimchi is one. And then there were some examples from your travel of different types of fermented foods that I had never even heard of. And so one of the things I loved about the book was it kind of reminded me of Parts Unknown, you know, the sort of Anthony Bourdain type thing where you got to go to Greece, I think, and Japan and celebrate some of the local foods. And I guess in a way, try them. You'd never tried some of them either. What? Take us through some of those specific foods, if you would.
Yeah, so that was one of the really exciting things, was to get to go to these different places. And I'd kind of selected a specific food that I was interested in and investigating and researching in each place. In Greece, it was yogurt, of course. Switzerland was some of the cheeses, especially from the Alpine regions, have been found to have probiotic bacteria in them when we still consume them, which I also think is good news. That's another fun food to add. And then in Japan, I was looking into miso, and Korea, obviously kimchi, as you mentioned. But one of the exciting, cool things was to arrive at these places and just find the richness of other fermented foods and just how many foods so many of these cultures have around the world that are integrated daily into their meals. And we really don't always think about that as being such an integral part of our everyday eating experience. You know, I think we kind of tend to think about, oh, I'll grab this yogurt and that'll fix my microbiome and then I can move on to my normal diet. But for example, in Korea, just going to some of the food markets, just so many different types of fermented foods beyond kimchi. There's fermented soybean paste, like miso, fermented sauces, fermented crab meat. It's just an endless variety. And really, I think to a lot of Koreans, to have a meal without one of these fermented products kind of feels lacking or unbalanced in a way. And then really in my own life, as I've started to eat more of these foods, you do kind of get accustomed to that different acidic kind of spicy bite. And so some of the foods that you used to eat kind of feel bland or boring without that addition too.
But you make the good caveat, I think, that it's easy to, I think, to read your book and fall into this idea that, you know, we all should be eating these fermented foods all the time. And you point out in these cultures where a lot of these fermented foods are very native to the cuisine that even these folks are not eating them for all foods at all meals. I mean, it's just part of the diet. It's a very well-balanced diet.
Yes, absolutely. And I got to speak with Sandor Katz, who's a fermentation guru in the U.S., and he's just done so much work in the field and written books about it as well. And, you know, he said too, you know, I don't sit down to a bowl full of kimchi for lunch. I use it as a condiment, as it is in its kind of native culture. And that's, I think, one takeaway too from my reporting was just the fact that, you know, these are just, as you said, a part of the cuisine. They're not the main focus by any means either.
So Sandor Katz was kind of a great character in your book. What was it? He has a nickname, right?
Yes, Sandor Kraut.
So sauerkraut is obviously one of these foods. But one of the things that I also learned that was great about the book, so when you talk about fermenting grain, of course, the conversation does kind of shift to alcohol. But then there were these two chapters. One was on legumes and seeds, which are foods that keep so well in their dried form and can really be, you know, on a shelf almost forever before you prepare them for a meal. But yet there are people who are fermenting these kinds of beans and seeds, which I thought was interesting. So let's start there. So what are some examples of fermented beans or seeds? You sort of alluded to some of them earlier.
Yeah, so miso paste would be one, fermented soybeans. And in Japan, there's another popular food called natto, which is fermented whole soybeans. And that's a really interesting food because most of the fermented foods we encounter or think of are fermented kind of in this acidic direction, which makes them safe from harmful bacteria and healthy for us. But natto and some other fermented beans and seeds actually go in an alkaline direction, which gives them a completely different flavor profile. Some people have compared natto to kind of extremely stinky cheeses. I actually happened to really like it once I tried it. I was a little nervous because I'd been warned about its strong flavor, but it does have an interesting texture, kind of gooey, but I thought it was really delicious. And that's just a whole other category of fermented foods that I think really haven't quite made it to the States yet.
As you point out, it's a base, so it's different on the different end of the pH scale than most of these acidic foods we think of as fermented. But when you, I guess, first approached it, if I recall correctly, when you were writing about it, you sort of opened up, I think, a package of it, and you were expecting this powerful aroma, and I think it was maybe a little bit disappointing in that you didn't really know you're supposed to spend, is it like 6 minutes or something, stirring it with your chopsticks mm-hmm. in order to bring out the aromas?
Yeah, there's a whole kind of ritual around this, you know, ideal natto consistency, and yeah, you stir it with your chopsticks for a long time, which kind of, yeah, brings out the flavor and the gooier texture, which was really, really interesting too, to learn about the ways, not just what foods are consumed and in what combination, but the ways in people approach their food and consume their food, which are often a lot different than how we do it here.
So natto is, I think you mentioned it hits the umami sense of taste, which is that sort of that fifth taste sense. Then we think about salty, sweet, bitter, and I guess I always forget the fourth one, but then umami is that kind of special one that it's hard for us to describe, and it really kind of hits that taste bud. Is that the one, that mm-hmm. natto? Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about meat. So when we think of fermenting meat, first of all, when we think about preserving meat, you know, we think about salting it or something like that. And of course, in evolutionary terms, we think of meat as something that we were sort of, as hunter-gatherers in our early evolutionary history, we were lucky if we came across meat. And so it was something we wanted to maybe indulge or overindulge in because we didn't know when we'd get our next meat meal. But I guess when you think about fermentation of meat, you think about rotting in a way. But you educated me and the readers about this. So take us through a thought process on fermented meat. I guess I was really surprised. This is more in Europe than in the U.S. where we have all kinds of, we pasteurize things. But sausage, for example, that's not really cooked, that's one example. But tell us some other examples of fermented meat.
Yeah, and I was surprised to learn that too in researching this book. I never really thought of sausage as a fermented meat product, but it really is, as you mentioned, especially in Europe. But there are just so many different other kinds of fermented meats. A lot of them are fish, especially in Asian cultures and traditions. There are a lot of different fermented fishes in Northern Europe. There's fermented shark and also some fermented canned fish, which undergo part of their fermentation in their can and have a notoriously strong smell. And a lot of these, some of these fermentations are also, like the natto beans, on the base or the alkaline side of the pH scale. So they can also have some flavors and odors that we're not as accustomed to and can be, I think, kind of challenging if you didn't grow up eating them.
There's this one, the Swedish one, that's the fish in a can. I'm going to try to say it. Surströmming, is that how you say it? Something like that.
Something like that. I'm not entirely sure either.
Yeah, but this was something, again, that is, would you call it a staple of a Swedish or Northern European diet, or more, it's not a delicacy per se, but it may not be something they eat every day, or is it in the wintertime, for example?
I don't think it's necessarily a staple, but I do think it's, you know, it's a common food that people do encounter. And I even read about they'll have specific kind of get-togethers or parties to eat this food. And it's generally opened and enjoyed outdoors where there's a little bit more fresh air. But I've been told that the bark is kind of worse than its bite. The smell's a little bit stronger than its actual flavor. But, you know, again, like so many other foods, it's not eaten every day for lunch as the main entree. It's kind of this more special occasion food that's eaten as part of a wider variety of foods for a meal.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Catherine Harmon Courage, who's a journalist and author of the brand new book, Cultured, How Ancient Foods Can Feed Our Microbiome. She's going to be appearing here in Tulsa, her hometown, on March 20th at 7 p.m. at Magic City Books to talk about her research and her book and sign some copies for interested listeners. And Catherine, you wrote a previous book called Octopus, The Most Mysterious Creature in the Sea. And I guess I haven't had a chance to look at it, but I'm really curious. Tell us a little bit about the octopus, because I guess all of us as kids are probably pretty interested in octopus. We learn they have 8 arms and things like that. But they are these really spectacular creatures who turn out to have a great deal of intelligence.
Yeah, they are fascinating. And as you mentioned, they're incredibly smart, but they're brain and nervous system is built entirely different from ours. So a lot of their neurons and even some kind of like, you could almost think of them as sub or mini brains, are diffused throughout their body. So they have a lot different control over their arms and just a very different experience, I think, of the world than we do. And they're also just, I'm always fascinated by their camouflaging abilities. They can, there's some amazing videos online. You can just watch them go just in a second from looking like an octopus to looking like a piece of rock or some kelp on the ocean floor. It's just really incredible. And researchers are still trying to understand exactly how they manage to do this kind of color matching and texture matching. It's just pretty fascinating.
And so how did you get interested enough to write a book about octopi and then go from there to the microbiome beat?
Kind of in a similar fashion. While I was working at Scientific American, came across a study of these octopuses who were living on the ocean floor in an area where there weren't a lot of rocks to hide under. And they were collecting these discarded coconut shell halves and carrying them around and hiding in them when they felt threatened. And this kind of demonstrated that they had some ability to kind of plan for the future and use tools in a sense. And so seeing that study, which came with a great and fairly hilarious video too, from the researchers, really piqued my interest in thinking, wow, you know, I really kind of lumped octopuses in with so many other ocean creatures and thinking, well, they're kind of cool looking and don't know too much about them. But just to realize that they do have this incredible intelligence and they're able to deploy it in ways that at least I wouldn't have expected. So that really got me interested in them and started finding more and more octopus research and realized that it was an interesting topic for a book. And they're also so culturally and culinarily relevant too in so many cultures around the world. So it was interesting to explore those as well. So I got to do some traveling and research for that book too.
So how does it work in terms of your career as a journalist when you get interested in something you've written about and want to take it deeper? Is it sort of easy to mix in the time to do a book with other articles you're writing, or do you take a leave of absence? Or, I mean, does that just depend on the situation, I guess?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. My octopus book I wrote while I was still working full-time at Scientific American and was able just to took some vacation time to do the travel part of my reporting and for the rest of it, evenings and weekends. This past book I wrote after I went freelance and became an independent journalist. And so I was able to do most of the writing and reporting then, but then kind of balanced revisions and everything else with a day job. So yeah, I think it just kind of depends, but I think it helps to have a subject that you're really interested in and passionate about to find the time and energy to work on a full book-length project.
So how did you become interested in science journalism as a direction to go in, or was it more that you were generally interested in journalism and sort of wound up, your curiosity led you to science, or did you always know you were going to write about science?
Yeah, I definitely did not always know I was going to write about science. I was an English major, but I will say I was raised in kind of a sciencey household. My mom is now a middle school science teacher. My dad's a computer network engineer. So just kind of being raised in this environment where science was being discussed and just kind of part of everyday conversation and just that kind of underlying curiosity about the world. But, you know, then I went to college and became an English major and didn't think too much about the hard sciences. But then I realized I did want to write more for my career. I was working in book publishing actually at the time on the editorial and marketing side. And then decided to go to journalism school for my master's degree. While I was there, I needed to find a topic for a thesis and really got very interested in this concept of explanatory journalism. There's actually a whole Pulitzer dedicated to it. And that's just the idea of taking a topic, maybe it's complex, and just, you know, helping to explain it to the readership. And I thought, well, this is such a powerful, I think, important part of our society, especially as things get so much more complex, you know, whether it's political or the business world, economics, whatever, just kind of understanding our world a little bit better so that we can make more informed decisions in our everyday life. So I was in journalism school during the financial downturn, actually, and got really interested in finance and business journalism too, but also kind of had this inkling that, you know, science and health and environment were also extremely important issues to help kind of provide explanation for. So ended up getting an internship at Scientific American, and that's how I fell into the science side.
Wow. And so you've also, according to your bio, have had publications or been published in the New York Times, Wired, National Geographic, and Popular Science, among other publications. Is there anything you can teach us about what writing for any of those is like, or is it just a matter of do your best and hope they land?
Yeah, I think that is it. Often takes some persistence and also just kind of finding the right story for the right publication, because obviously each publication has its own voice and its own audience, and trying to figure out, you know, once you find a story that you're interested in, where the best home for it would be.
One of your articles, I guess, or your writing about experimental immune treatments was featured in Best American Science and Nature Writing back in 2013. So that must have been a welcome letter to get, that you were going to, some of your work was going to be published in sort of the Best American series.
Yeah, I was really honored by that. That was wonderful. That was actually came out of a news, really short kind of breaking news story that I did while I was still at Scientific American about the Nobel Prize winners, kind of covered the Nobels as they came out, announced early in the morning in U.S. time. And it was ended up being a developing story because one of the recipients of the Health and Medicine Nobel that year, it came out later in the day, had actually just passed away. And that's one of the rules of the Nobels, is they're not allowed to be awarded to deceased people. So there was kind of a hubbub and a question of whether he would still retain the Nobel. It was decided he would. But then diving more into his research, and it was just really fascinating. So just kind of followed that trail from the breaking news story into a larger feature about the kind of research he was doing. And actually the research that he had dedicated his career toward ended up, you know, a lot of people think kind of prolonging his life in the cancer that he had. He'd been looking at cancer immunotherapy treatments. So he kind of experimented on himself, which was really fascinating.
Yeah, I remember that story. And when he died right around the time of the announcement, that was very interesting. I had no idea that was what your reporting was on. That's fascinating. Catherine, I wanted to know if after doing this book, Cultured, your latest book, how your dietary habits may have changed, or if it's not too soon after the publication, are there habits you've changed in terms of what you eat or how you feed your family?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do try to eat more fermented foods now and a wider variety of them. And I think one, maybe even more so than that, is just focusing on getting a lot of whole fibers in my diet, to think about that prebiotic fiber that's actually feeding my native gut microbes and those in my family as well.
The name of the new book is Cultured, How Ancient Foods Can Feed Our Microbiome. And it's just out from Avery, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And it's by my guest today, Catherine Harmon Courage, who is a journalist, author, and an editor. And she will be appearing in Tulsa at Magic City Books on March 20th at 7 p.m. to talk about this new book. Catherine Harmon Courage, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.